From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A man walks through an Iowa cornfield and hears a voice whispering, "If you build it, he'll come." The he is Shoeless Joe Jackson. The movie, Field of Dreams, starring Kevin Costner. It's a classic. And there's a kernel of truth in this story. In real life Iowa, a baseball whisperer named Merle Eberle became a coach and father figure to ballplayers who had big dreams and raw talent. More than 300 of his players went on to sign professional contracts, including Hall of Famer Ozzie Smith and Major League stars Bud Black, Von Hayes, and Chuck Knobloch. This hour, On Point, a special coach and the boys of summer in one small Iowa town. You can join us on air or online. What is it about summer and baseball that brings us to the park? Do you know of summer leagues for young talent in Alaska, Cape Cod, elsewhere around the country? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, later this hour, we expect to hear from Hall of Famer Ozzie Smith, who played for the Clarinda, Iowa A's. Joining us now from Washington is Mike Tackett, an editor in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and my longtime colleague, former managing editor of Bloomberg, Washington Bureau Chief of the Chicago Tribune, and national editor for U.S. News and World Report. His new book is The Baseball Whisperer, a small-town coach who shaped big league dreams. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mike Tackett, thanks for being with us.
John, thanks for having me.
Let me start by just asking you, for our listeners who are not familiar, to paint the picture of who Merle Eberle was and how he came to create this baseball team.
Merle Eberle is a man that grows up in rural Iowa under tough circumstances. His parents get divorced when he's a young man. He goes off to live with his mother, ends up in Omaha, Nebraska, is doing really poorly, is dropped out of school, has taken on bad habits, really is rudderless in his life. And so his mother decides to send him back to Clarinda, Iowa, and to send him to a place where she thinks that he can be sort of redeemed and restored. So he goes back there and lives with his grandparents, and he's still sort of at sea, not really doing well. At that point, he meets a coach named John Tidor at Clarinda High School. John Tidor had just come back from World War II. He was a combat veteran, highly decorated, was also the quarterback of the University of Iowa's football team. Merle Eberle was looking for someone like this in his life for as long as he'd been alive, and he found him in John Tidor. Tidor challenged him to come out for sports or just get out of the way, and Merle embraced that challenge. He became the person that John Tidor hoped he would be. And Merle Eberle knew that as an athlete, he had been redeemed. He became a tremendous baseball player, played three sports, also set the school record in something they called the football toss because they didn't have a javelin throw back then. And then he goes on to have his own stint as a baseball player, including signing a professional contract with the Chicago White Sox. So he got his shot to play. He never made it to the major leagues. And he came back to Clarinda to be a coach.
What year are we talking about now?
Pardon me?
What year are we talking about now when he went back to Clarinda?
Now we're talking about the early 1950s. So he goes back to Clarinda, Iowa, and he's sort of a hero because he's had the credibility of being a professional baseball player. But more important to him was what baseball could mean to him, to his town, and to the people he played with and to people he coached.
Now, he made a team that the character of which changed over time. It didn't start out to be a team for college kids in the summer. Tell me about that transition, how it went from one thing, became another.
Well, back in that era in the 1950s, particularly in the Midwest, a lot of small towns had what they just called town teams. And they would travel from one town to another, and they would play each other as a way to sort of win bragging rights between two little places.
Were they pros? So were they getting paid?
Sometimes they did. It was sort of like a semi-pro situation. Most often they did not. And the team was called the Clarinda Merchants. And starting in 1960, Merle became not only the starting catcher, but also was the manager of the team. And the team evolved over the course of a decade, and they thought they were pretty good. And then one time, in the late 1960s, they took a trip out to Colorado. and they played against some collegiate teams. And then they found out that they really weren't that good, that in fact they were older, they were breaking down, and these college kids were really great. So he wanted to keep baseball in Clarinda. That was really important to him because he knew that it gave the town a sense of identity. So in the early 1970s, he decides to try to form a collegiate team. And he goes to people in town, and he's a little dubious as to what's going to happen because he thinks he needs $10,000 in the early 1970s to start this team. Instead, he finds that the town is totally supportive of what he wants to do. They donate the money, and he starts the team that becomes the Clarinda A's.
Now, that team had to compete with summer baseball for college kids in the Cape Cod League, which is very successful, in Alaska, a little more exotic. How did he persuade kids to come to the middle of nowhere in Iowa at that point?
This is a great part of the story because this kind of shows you what kind of a character he was and what kind of character others saw in him. He would go to annual coaches' conventions and meet and network with college coaches. And he would talk to them about the game. He would talk to them about his own experience. And he would talk to them about the virtues of Clarinda, Iowa. And he would try to make its very, what some people would see as its liabilities, the fact that it's isolated, the fact that it's very small, rural, not fancy, and turn those into virtues and tell the coaches, your player will be in a nurturing environment. Your player is going to get great opportunity. And we're going to travel and play really good teams. In fact, one year when Ozzie Smith was there, they went to Alaska and they played against the Alaska teams, the Fairbanks Gold Panners and others among them. And they actually had a winning record on that road trip. No other team who had gone up to Alaska to try to do that had had that kind of a fate. So all these sorts of things became cumulative. The program became better known, and more players and more coaches wanted to come there.
Now, what he was selling, as I understand it, was old school at a time when baseball was changing, the culture was changing, the society was changing. That's not an easy thing to sell, the guy with the buzz cut who won't let the players even have so much as a mustache.
Yeah, that was sort of the fun part about it was he would have these kind of rules that you think back to an earlier time where your shoes had to be shined, your face had to be shaven, your hair had to be trimmed. In fact, at the local barbershop in town, if a player didn't have his hair cut the right way, Merle would send him to the barbershop, and the barber knew exactly what a Merle-approved haircut would look like. But it was interesting that not a lot of kids fought it. Most of them, in fact, embraced it, and they looked at it as just sort of part of their own growing and part of their own becoming kind of professional. Because when you're in one of these summer league teams like this, it really is replicates like life in the minor leagues. You have long bus rides. You have bad hotels. You have a limited amount of meal money. So it really tests your own dedication to the game, to how good do you want to be and what kind of sacrifices are you willing to make to get there.
Now, one of the things I really loved about your book is the way that the subject came to you organically through your life. That's how you found Merle Eberle. Talk a little bit about how that happened.
Well, our son was a college baseball player who had been released from his team after his freshman season and didn't want to give up. He wanted to keep playing. And so the only way to do that would be to try to reestablish yourself with a collegiate summer team.
So he still thought he could turn into Ozzie Smith at that point.
That was the dream, of course. And so he writes 100 teams seeking an opportunity. One team wrote him back and said yes, and it was the Clarinda A's. So he gets in the car.
Why do you think that is, by the way? If 100 teams turned him down, why did Merle Eberle want your son?
Well, it was interesting that Merle initially was skeptical. Merle thought, well, you know, that probably wouldn't work out too well if this is his circumstance. But Merle's wife, Pat, after reading the letter that he wrote, said, well, isn't this really the kind of person who we want here, and isn't this really why we have the program that we have? Merle was then convinced. He went out there. Merle saw him play and said, well, indeed, you do fit in here, and this is going to work out just fine. And it did.
Wow. And tell me about your interaction with Eberle. What did you observe of him as a manager and a man?
Well, one of the challenges in doing The Baseball Whisperer was that I didn't have much access to Merle. In fact, I met him one time when we went out for a parents' weekend to watch some games during that summer. At that point, Merle was not in great health, but he got up and he spoke before all the parents, and really, you could sort of get a sense of the charisma even then, when he wasn't in his prime, and that really intrigued me about this story. And then when you go to the ball field and you see at Municipal Stadium the plaques of all the players who have made it to the major leagues, the pictures of people like Ozzie Smith and others who have been great supporters of the program long after their playing days were over. It was really sort of baseball at its essence, and I think that's also part of the power and the pull of the program.
And I imagine you heard a lot from, even though you only met him once, you probably heard a lot from your son after that summer.
Oh, yes, because at that point, Merle's sort of taken on the general manager role of the team. And so what he would do is he had a little metal chair and he would sit past the dugout and observe every single play that went on and critique many of those plays and give the umpires some helpful guidance if he thought that they made a bad call. So he was a person who was still sort of the rock of the program. But I think a testament to what he built is that the program has endured since his passing away several years ago. And now his wife, Pat, and son, Ryan, really run the program. And Pat Eberle, as it turns out, as I found during the course of my research, almost everyone says she was every bit as integral to the program as Merle.
So she now plays the general manager role and the son is the coach manager?
Right, on the field.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about summer baseball leagues and the remarkable story of how Clarinda, Iowa coach Merle Eberle turned young ball players into major league stars. You can join the conversation. Have you dreamed of being a professional baseball player? Could a coach like Merle Eberle help you get closer to your dreams? We're talking with Mike Tackett, an editor in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and author of the new book, The Baseball Whisperer, a small-town coach who shaped big league dreams. I want to start, Mike, by giving our listeners a little flavor of the sound of the Clarinda A's. You know, baseball, whether it's at the little league level or the major league level, ultimately comes down to the same sequence of events, the same kinds of plays. Here's a little bit from July 23rd when the St. Joseph's Mustangs from Missouri lost to the Clarinda A's.
There's two down at the bottom of the ninth. Matt Walnick up to bat. Ground ball over to short. He's digging really hard. Throw to first base. In time for out number three. And the Mustangs fall to the Clarinda A's 3-2.
Mike, baseball in the cornfield. Sounds pretty good.
Oh, you can't beat it. I could tell that was the St. Joseph's announcer. The Clarinda has a retired radio broadcaster who does sort of their on-field announcing. And he's got just a terrific voice. And when you go there, you know, it's not hard to get a good seat.
Now, one of the things that came across crystal clear in the book is that Merle Eberle wasn't just a coach. It wasn't just about making Ozzie Smith, the skinny college player, into a star. It was about an approach to the game, an approach to life, a set of values that he was trying to impart to players that we used to think of coaches like Vince Lombardi and other well-known sort of stout characters imparting, but you don't hear that so much anymore. Talk a little bit about that.
He really believed that he was trying to make people into better men, not simply better baseball players. And by that, understanding the values of loyalty, the values of commitment, the values of selflessness. And he exemplified that on his own as a coach. And a lot of players who pass through Clarinda say that their own lives were really transformed by this. I mean, one of the things to remember is that he had a rule once he started the collegiate team, and that was no one got paid. No one got a single cent of compensation. So Merle Eberle would spend uncounted hours every summer and many hours during the winter in preparation to keep this program alive, for expecting nothing in return financially. But what he did was he established relationships with people. And that really helped him throughout his life, too, especially when things turned tough for him from a health perspective. all sorts of players came back, you know, to greet him, to talk to him, to try to help him through his own tough time.
Now, he was a quirky guy, it sounded like. He had his rules. He had the things he would call out to players. You mention repeatedly in the book that he had a way of calling for players to hustle, and he would say, "Hobby dobby." Explain that to me.
I wish I could. I mean, that's sort of a mystery, and not even his own family really knows where it came from. But it was just something that he said, and it became sort of a signature. And eventually, the players made some wristbands that said "Hobby Dobby" on that.
One of the things that the anecdotes that I found most impressive from the book was the story of Jamie Carroll, who went on to have a baseball career of about a dozen years. And everyone who encountered Jamie Carroll said that he was the most relentlessly giving maximum effort kind of player that they had seen. He'd run as fast to first base if he was popping up or grounding out as he would if he had a double in the corner. Some of that was the influence of Merle Eberle.
No doubt about it. I mean, when I talked to Jamie Carroll, he said that he actually loved the atmosphere there. He loved Merle's approach to the game. He loved the idea of that you get out of it what you put into it. I mean, Jamie actually played on the same team as Merle's youngest son, Rod Eberle, who was a terrific player in his own right and also had a year in professional baseball. And Rod said that in that lineup, Jamie Carroll was just sort of average. But in terms of his approach to the game, he was really above almost everyone. And then I talked to the man who scouted Jamie Carroll professionally. And as you just said, I mean, what struck him the most was he timed him from home to first on a ground ball to deep shortstop. And then he timed it from home to first on an easy comeback to the pitcher. And he had exactly the same time to first base both times. So Jamie Carroll didn't have necessarily what they call plus tools, but he had a plus heart, and it, you know, it served him pretty well.
Mike, joining me now from St. Louis, Missouri, is Ozzie Smith. He's the Hall of Fame shortstop for the San Diego Padres and St. Louis Cardinals from 1978 to 1997. Ozzie Smith played for Earl Eberle on the Clarinda A's. Ozzie, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, how you guys doing?
We're doing great. I want to hear from you. Everyone knows Ozzie Smith, but very few people know Merle Eberle. tell us what effect he had on your baseball career and your life.
Well, it was really, you know, for a young man coming from South Central Los Angeles, it's kind of a eye-opening experience for me, going back to a little small town in Clarinda, Iowa, and having them opening their arms, their homes, and their community to an African American player, which at the time I was one of the only ones on the team, and you know, coming from my background, it was very eye opening, and those the people there in the town, and not only Merle, I think it was the whole town, they were very, very they were special because to them there was no color. They took young men in, and it was more about developing people than it was necessarily developing baseball players. Yes, we were there for baseball, but it was really about developing young men, and I think that that's what made Merle and all of the people in the town such a special experience for me. So it's all about life's lessons and how you go forward and how you can contribute and how you can give back, and that probably is one of the most important things that I learned as I took that journey.
Was there anything baseball-wise that he changed, contributed to your career, either something about your swing or offensively or something out in the field?
Well, you know what it was? It was work ethic and stuff more than anything, and this was where I consider myself very fortunate in that everybody in my life, all of the people that were instrumental, were all preaching the same lesson, and that was pretty much the lesson that Merle taught all of the young men that came there. He taught them about being responsible. He taught them about being respectful, and knowing that you're only going to get out of something what you put in it. And, you know, with that philosophy, Merle didn't have a lot of rules, you know, so it was basically about giving your all every day for those 4 hours that you're out there. And if you do that, then you had no problems. And for the guys that couldn't abide by the simple rules that he had, you know, they weren't there very long.
Ozzy, I want to play a little clip from one of your last seasons in 1995, opening day in St. Louis, and you're running out to the field. Let's take a listen.
The oldest shortstop in the history of the National League to start on a ball club and on an opening day. And Ozzie Smith is indeed the wizard, and this is the land of Oz, and what a career it has been for old number one.
Now, Ozzie, I believe that was Joe Buck speaking right after you had done your signature backflip when you ran onto the field. I read in Mike Tackett's book that you performed that flip in Clarinda. Was that the first time you performed it?
No, I guess growing up as a kid in South Central Los Angeles, if I can indulge you here very quickly, I grew up across the street from a wood factory where we used to go over and tumble in the sawdust. And it was one of those things that I was able to do because, you know, we were, I think in my time, we were more creative as kids at developing ways to play and have fun and everything. And tumbling was one of those things. I used to go to the family fun centers on Thursdays where they had trampolines in the ground and tumble from one trampoline to the other. And so it was one of those things that I could do. And when I got to Clarinda, I can't remember whether or not I was asked to do it or why they came up. Now, I know that it started in the big leagues because I had teammates that were interested in. I had Gene Tennis, who was a teammate. His girls were into gymnastics, and he had asked me to do it, going out to my position. And I didn't do it. I was reluctant to do it because of the chicken. The chicken was the entertainment there in San Diego at the time. But anyway, long story short, I did it going out to my position, and they liked it so much they asked me to do it opening day the following year, and lo and behold, it became my trademark.
Now, try to put for our listeners in perspective Merle as compared to some of the more famous managers. You played for Whitey Herzog. You played for Joe Torre. You played for Tony La Russa. Compare those guys with old school Merle Eberle.
Well, I mean, here again, I think it's the one of the qualities that they all have. You have to have a certain temperament, first of all, to be a manager, and you have to be able to deal with people. And I think that that's one of the things that they all possess, the ability to deal with people and to be able to get through to people and understand if they're not getting through to someone, then having the ability to see someone on the team that they feel that could, and relegating that authority, giving them the authority or the ability to go out and get the message across. And all of these, the managers that you mentioned, Joe Torre, Whitey Herzog, Tony, they all possess that special thing at being able to deal with people and having an understanding and always trying to keep them in a position of success. And Merle certainly possessed those same qualities and same traits, and it was a lot of fun playing for him as well as those other guys.
I want to take a call right now. We've got Steve on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Steve, welcome to On Point. What's your comment or question for Ozzie Smith and Mike Tackett?
Hi, John. Gentlemen, just a quick story, a personal story. I happened to be in Clarinda, Iowa, by chance, with my 12-year-old son about 25 years ago. And we were looking around for something to do that night after a bite to eat, and we saw the lights off at the baseball field. So we gravitated over there and didn't realize what a gem that was. It was a great experience. We could sense the community spirit. They had a few more fans there that night, so I remember the announcer saying, "We don't usually announce the starting lineups, but since we've got such a crowd here tonight, we're going to announce the lineups." It was great. And only after being there and getting that sense of something special did I come to find out the history and the story, and I just love this story. It's a great American story.
It is a great American story. Steve, let me ask you this. Did you missed Ozzie Smith by a few years when you went to that game 25 years ago, but was there anyone else that you saw that you later remembered seeing in the major leagues?
I don't remember the specific players except some of the colleges that were mentioned, and there were some from my area in Middle Tennessee and in Southern Kentucky that were playing summer ball there. But I can tell you how many locals were proud to mention that, you know, Ozzie Smith played here. You know, Ozzie was here. I don't know how many people told me that. It was just a great part of the fabric of the community.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for calling. Ozzie, talk about the summer. You spent one summer at Clarinda, correct? Two.
Right, two summers.
Okay.
Two summers there.
Tell me about your teammates, who where they were from. What you know, you were from Watts. Where were your teammates from?
Yeah, we had a lot of guys from California. We had a lot of guys from Texas. And I think the majority of the team was made up of guys from California and Texas. And you know, I think some of the guys from the local area there, too, you know, guys like Bob Serve, Noel Badansky, and Jack Shoup were all guys that were local guys there. And I think Bob Serve Jr. also played in the major league, so it was his son that I had a chance to play with, and guys like Tommy Higgins. It made it a lot of fun to play with guys who had some experience and guys who – I think for most of us, we had somewhere to go, so we were always working on the craft at getting better. And when you have a coach like Merle who was preaching that you know, we've got to continue to play as consistently as we possibly can, and in hopes of, you know, making it to the NBC the conference at the tournament down in Wichita, which we were able to make a couple times and stuff, and that was really the goal. Just get better, be consistent, and good things would happen, and they certainly did for me.
Ozzie, one of the things I read in Mike Tackett's book, The Baseball Whisperer, is that Merle would also put players to work, whether it was bailing hay or working in a furniture store or whatever it was. What was your summer job?
John, that was part of the deal. You know, you had to come there and work, and when we talk about responsibility, taught you a lot of responsibility because I worked construction. I actually had a chance to work the jackhammer, which wasn't very good for me at night when I went up to the plate because my hands were still moving like the jackhammer when I got up to the plate. But it was that type of experience that gave me an understanding of the responsibility that I had as a young man coming into my own at the things that I had to do if I was going to be successful.
Well, maybe that jackhammer helped you hit some of those 28 home runs you hit in your career.
Well, it made me a little bit stronger. When I first started with it, it was throwing me around, but I eventually learned how to handle it. And
I think I read you were 140 pounds when you got to Clarinda.
You're right. The jackhammer was probably 120. So, you know, I was battling that, but they allowed me to do that, and I learned a lot about construction and stuff, and that I otherwise would not have had the opportunity. So, it wasn't just baseball that I went there and learned. It was really about life's lessons.
I read that Merle was skeptical in the beginning, and then he hit a million fungos to you. You caught every ground ball, and that was enough to seal the deal.
Well, I think that when I got off at 140 pounds, I think he was trying to decide whether or not who he was going to keep and who he wasn't. And his way of being able to get rid of me was to, you know, try and hit as many ground balls past me as he could. And as he quickly found out, that wasn't the easiest thing in the world to do.
Ozzie Smith, Hall of Fame shortstop with the Padres and the Cardinals from 1978 to 1997. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you guys for having me.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how one coach helped young ballplayers achieve their major league dreams in the small town of Clarinda, Iowa. You can join the conversation. What life lessons can we learn from Merle Eberle? Was there a coach like him in your life? We're talking with Mike Tackett, an editor in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and author of the new book, The Baseball Whisperer, a small-town coach who shaped big league dreams. Joining me now from Phoenix, Arizona, is Lee Tackett, Mike Tackett's son. He played baseball in Clarinda, Iowa, between the summer of his sophomore and junior years at Washington and Lee University in 2010. He then went on to play for the Prospect League of Richmond, Indiana. He now works in baseball operations for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Lee Tackett, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let me start out by just setting again the context for this field, baseball team in a cornfield in Iowa, because a lot of people have seen this moment from popular entertainment.
If you build it, he will come.
If you build it, he will come. That was a reference to Shoeless Joe Jackson. Of course, that was Kevin Costner's movie Field of Dreams. Now, I also want to play a clip before I ask Lee Tackett a question of Bud Black, one of Merle Eberle's players in Clarinda, who went on to pitch for 15 years in the major leagues. He then coached the Anaheim Angels, managed the San Diego Padres, and in 2010, he told YFIT TV what it takes to be a good coach.
For me, I think a coach takes on three roles. First, teacher. Second, leader. Third, motivator. When I think of a coach, I think of those three things. But I think the primary focus is a teacher.
Lee Tackett, what did you learn in Clarinda, Iowa?
I think the importance of work ethic is something that's very evident when you're out there. You know, there's not a lot to do other than play baseball. You know, wake up in the morning, I'd go to my job, which was on the paint crew. So that was painting a barn out on a farm. You know, kill time for a little bit and go to the ballpark every day.
And what was your position?
I was a relief pitcher.
And did you find that summer the competition better or worse than what you had seen at W&L?
Oh, better. I went to a very small school. You know, you look at the roster of the other teams in Clarinda, and, you know, it's Big 12, Pac-12, SEC schools. It was definitely different from what I was used to in the Old Dominion Athletic Conference.
So this was, from your perspective, this was a major league operation.
Absolutely. It was a huge step up from what I was used to.
And did you have a successful summer in Clarinda?
I did. I had changed my arm angle from an over-the-top traditional delivery to a submariner, so I really needed innings and I needed reps, and I needed confidence. And getting to go out and pitch in Clarinda gave that to me.
Tell me about Merle and your interactions with him.
Well, when I first got there, I was one of the first guys to arrive, and he kind of said, you know, I don't care about how your college season went. You're going to pitch here, and you're going to do well. And setting tone like that, you know, that was really all I needed to hear.
And tell me about your baseball career after Clarinda. As Michael said earlier, you had big league dreams. How did that play out?
Well, you know, not every career ends in the big leagues, but I did get to go on and have a successful career at Washington and Lee. And then the following two summers, I played in the Prospect League in Richmond, Indiana. So that let me see another part of the country. But, you know, Clarinda really, it did a lot to kind of revive my career and let me continue playing.
Well, what you just described is a success by any standard. I'm reminded of many other players who have fallen short, including me. I once dreamed of being a big league player. I think I peaked in the sixth grade. And I've got a note here from a tweet from a listener on Twitter, Jim Kerr, who said, "Dreamed of playing pro? I laugh about it now. I was told I had a gun in the glove. Too bad you can't teach foot speed." So everybody's got a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think you quickly realize when you're playing in these summer leagues how high the bar is set. You know, I think off of my Clarinda team, one guy went on to play professionally. But, you know, a lot of guys had very successful college careers. You know, it was fun to turn on the TV a year after I'd been in Clarinda and see a guy I played with, Grant Clyde, was playing for NC State in a College World Series. So that, you know, the level of talent on our team and in that league, you know, is very high.
Let's go to the phones. We've got John calling from Council Bluffs, Iowa. John, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Yeah, this question for Mike, and maybe kind of piggybacks on what the previous person was just saying. Do you have any feel for the future of the Clarinda A's in terms of, it seems like it's been a while since they've had anybody make the pros, and you hear all about like the Cape Cod League, and around here in the Midwest we have the Northwoods League. Do you have a feel for the caliber of the players that Clarinda is able to draw compared to what they used to back in the 70s and the 80s?
Well, I think all summer teams face a little bit of that challenge because a lot of coaches now are much more protective of their players, particularly pitchers, and they may want to keep them on campus, and so that hurts a little bit. I think that the video capabilities, the real-time video capabilities that teams have means that fewer and fewer scouts need to go and do this. And that's why I think the Eberle family and the people of Clarinda realized that there were two purposes here, but one was more important. And the more important one was to provide opportunity for players and to provide chances for players. And they cared less about, you know, how many major league players are we going to turn out. Although I will say, though, just this weekend I was watching the Washington Nationals play the Colorado Rockies, and Daniel Descalzo, the shortstop for the Rockies, played for the Clarinda A's.
Lee, do you get a sense that your peers from your recent college experience who are really gifted, would they rather go to Cape Cod or go to Alaska than go to the Midwest?
I think it takes a certain kind of person to succeed in Clarinda. It's definitely a lower profile league. You don't have some of the frills. You don't always have scouts at your games. But you find good moments. Where
you have to work on the paint crew.
Then there's 4,000. Yeah, you have to work on the paint crew. I think you're asked to do a little bit more in Clarinda, but I think it's definitely worth it.
If you play in the Cape Cod League, do they make you have a day job?
You often do. Yeah. In fact, there's a great book about that called The Last Best League that came out probably 10 years or so ago about one season in the Cape Cod League, and a lot of those guys did also have those jobs. I mean, Cape Cod is definitely sort of the premier venue. The Alaska League certainly attracts an extraordinary number of players. And these leagues have proliferated around the country.
Got the Walter Johnson League in Washington, right?
Absolutely. So, and it's all really fun, good, high-level baseball.
Let's take another call. We've got Jim on the line from Long Lake, New York. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Nice talking to you.
Sure. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to make a point about how special it was in baseball in our little town of DeLand, Florida. Growing up, my father had gotten a group of men together and started to do the Little League program there. And we also had Stetson University, which has put out a number of Major League Baseball players. And how special it was for those kids to go to Cape Cod every summer to play. And I was going to ask the same question, how do you see the future of those leagues coming along? But I just think that it's really great that we have a place for those kids to go. And I've seen games in Alaska. I've seen games in Cape Cod. I've seen games in Rhode Island. It's always a joy to see these players play.
And that's a father-son kind of activity, huh?
Correct. Absolutely. It was. I remember at 8 years old getting ready for my first Little League tryout, hitting baseballs in the backyard with Dad and saying, Dad, I eat right-handed. I throw right-handed. Why do I hit left-handed? Because Ted Williams told you to. Because he fished with Ted Williams in the 50s and 60s.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. Lee Tackett, did Mike teach you how to play?
Yeah, absolutely. I had kind of my best cheerleader every step of the way there. You know, if it were a phone call after a bad outing, or a pat on the back after things had gone well, he was there every step of the way.
Mike, were you a baseball player when you were a kid? And how far did you go?
I was, and I went as far as high school, and I loved it. It was a great adventure. My father had introduced the game to me, and just like the caller, I throw right-handed and bat left-handed.
The Clarinda story is amazing to me because, you know, we all saw Field of Dreams, and then as I'm turning the pages on your book, I'm seeing that
world spring to life. Did you have a deja vu feeling of life is richer than fiction?
I do think you get that sense. I mean, it extends to the fact that there's a cornfield outside the right field fence.
Describe the ballpark a little bit.
It's an old county kind of stadium with nice stadium seats, an old wooden press box. It's just across the street from the fairgrounds. The outfield fences all have advertising from local businesses that are there. There's a clubhouse, a concession stand, where you'll always see Pat Eberle and one of her daughters working no matter what, and every game that the Clarinda A's have there. So it's really it's charming, it's quaint, and it's really endured.
I think you said at the early in the book, correct me if I'm wrong, that in the beginning they didn't have fences, and so you could place the outfielders as deep as you wanted to keep somebody from hitting a home run. They got fences now?
They have fences indeed, and you know that was sort of in the lore of the old town team baseball, where they would just get some people, and some people may be able to hit the ball 500 miles. But they weren't very fast, so if they positioned their defense just right, they could hold anybody to a double.
How deep are those fences?
Lee probably would know that better than I. I mean, it's 330 maybe down the lines, and maybe closer to 400 to dead center.
Well, so similar to major league dimensions.
Oh yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hitters would talk all the time about how it was difficult to get a ball out there.
Tell me the quality of that field and that stadium. How did it compare to the stadiums you played college ball on?
Well, we were the ones who worked on it, so probably I don't think any of us were professional groundskeepers. But you know, it's up there with a college field.
Mm-hmm. Mike, do you sense that Merle's wife and son are going to be able to sustain this program in something similar to what Merle did? It's gone on for quite a long time, but things change.
Yeah, no question about that. And part of the reason that I think it has endured is the fact that they do it with no profit incentive. Some of the teams that that are out there, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that, they're also small businesses. And so they have to kind of turn a profit to stay in business. The Clarinda A's only have to break even to stay in business, and they've been able to do that. I think each year it does get a little bit tougher because you're relying on the commitment. You're relying on the families in town to agree to host players year after year. And so sustaining it, is certainly a challenge. Now, as of right now, Pat Eberle, she's in her, just turned 80, but she has more energy than I do, for sure. Her son Ryan is there, and then they have another son, Rod, who's now moved back to town. So that will help build some more infrastructure. I hope it goes on.
The throwback feel is remarkable as you go through this book. I want to play a little audio from the Iowa's KMA radio about the Page County Fair in Clarinda in 2014.
Hi, I'm Cheyenne French. I'm here at the Page County Fair 2014. We got the sheep show going on behind us here. Got a lot of nice, good-looking sheep out there. Got a couple friends I know, and they do a really good, nice job showing.
Lee Tackett, who draw more fans, the sheep show or the Clarinda A's?
Probably the sheep show on an average basis.
The what did that small-town atmosphere feel like to a big city kid like you?
I mean, it was definitely different. You had a McDonald's, a Subway, and that was pretty much it. It was all local businesses. If you needed to go to a Walmart, that was in the next town over. But you did start to build a familiarity with the town very quickly. It was pretty comforting for someone who's 20 hours away from home.
I want to give listeners a feel for some of the talent that passed through Clarinda. We heard from Ozzie Smith earlier. Also, Chuck Knobloch played for more than a decade for the Minnesota Twins, New York Yankees, and Kansas City Royals, second baseman, left field. He was a Clarinda A's alum. Here's him talking about his rookie year.
All I wanted to do was make the team, but once I did, didn't really think about rookie of the year or any things like that. Just know, I was wide-eyed, you know, open, didn't know what to expect. So, you know, all I want to do is be a part of a winner. And, you know, we've done a lot of that.
Mike Tackett, when you go to Clarinda, do they have one of those rings of fame like you see in a pro stadium with the names of Andy Bennis and Bud Black and Cal Eldred and Von Hayes along with Ozzie Smith?
They really do. And just one note about Ozzie Smith that I think is important to talk about, and that is his continued association with the family. I mean, he didn't just go there and leave. Throughout his playing career, whenever the Cardinals were in the playoffs, he had the Eberleys come to St. Louis, stay in his home. When he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2002, he had the Eberleys sitting in the front row, and he acknowledged the people of Clarinda in his speech. And then after Merle passed away, Ozzie commissioned a sculpture of Merle that's outside Memorial Stadium today. Which you can see. And then right behind that on the dugout, there are plaques of all the major league players, more than three dozen of them.
Wow. Well, Lee Tackett played for the Clarinda A's in 2010. He now works for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He spoke with me from Phoenix, Arizona. Lee Tackett, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Mike Tackett is the author of The Baseball Whisperer, a small town coach who shaped big league dreams. Mike, thanks so much. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, 41 cases of Zika confirmed in Singapore. U.S. health officials call to test all blood donations. We'll look at the global fight to stop Zika. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.